Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, September 27, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is a book review on Rachel Barco's book, Prisoners of Politics, Breaking the Cycle of Mass Incarceration. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Clark Neely, who is the Vice President for Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute. I'll leave it to Clark to introduce our author, Rachel Barco. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Clark, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks, Micah. It's really an honor to be able to have this event with someone I consider to have become a friend and fellow criminal justice reformer. Rachel Barco is a professor of law at New York University and the director of the Center on the Administration of Criminal Law there. She's a Harvard Law grad and a former Silberman and Scalia clerk. There's a large D.C. law firm before going off to teach law and advocate for criminal justice reform. I think her new book, Prisoner of Politics, is one of the most important and interesting books on the subject of criminal justice reform, and that'll be our topic today. But welcome, Rachel, and thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for everybody there who's listening.
So I think one of the most interesting things about criminal justice reform is that it is one of the small handful of really, truly cross-ideological issues in front of us today and truly bipartisan. There are very few people, I think, on the right or the left or even in the middle who don't agree on some level that there are significant problems in the criminal justice system and a need for significant reform. My perception, though, is that that's basically where agreement breaks down. Both the diagnosis and the prescriptions that we get from people differ radically, and also a decision about what to prioritize and where to focus. So before diving in and talking about the theme of your book and what you learned in the course of writing it, could you sort of set the stage for us by telling us what you think are sort of the most fundamental shortcomings, or as I sometimes say, pathologies in the criminal justice system? Where are we most fundamentally getting it wrong in your view?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is a lack of accountability for all of the actors who are involved in administering criminal laws and punishment in America. Because for the most part, whether it's prosecutors, whether it's sheriffs, whether it's prison officials, there is very little oversight of any of them. And in fact, not only little oversight, but a complete lack of information, frankly, about most of what it is that they do and how they're doing it, much less measuring results to see whether they're doing a good job. And I'll say good job here as measured by improving public safety, because I do think that's the space where, whether you vote left or right or somewhere in the middle, I think everyone expects the way that we administer criminal law in America should help to promote public safety. And what's inexplicable about the way we do things now is we don't check any of these actors to see whether they're doing a good job on that front. We don't ask any prison in the United States to give a check, hey, what happens to people after they're released from your facility? You know, what are the recidivism rates look like? Because if you're doing a terrible job and you're providing no programming and people come out of there worse off than when they went in, you're harming public safety. You're not making it better. You know, similarly, if you're a prosecutor's office and you're just bringing tons of low-level cases that frankly make it more difficult for people to then, after they go through the system, get jobs and get housing, and so, you know, they may end up committing more crimes as a result, you know, you're doing a terrible job. If you're not, you have low clearance rates in your community as a police force, and you have, you know, less than a 50% shot of getting anybody for the most serious crimes. In some places, it's 20%. You know, you're doing a terrible job. And the key thing I think that we should demand is a better framework for holding all of these actors who are doing their jobs accountable to make sure they're doing it right. Now, I think, you know, there may be disagreement among folks about how many people should be employed in these positions and the kind of people they want to select for it. But I think the common ground for starters for everybody should be making sure we know what they're doing and we hold them accountable for their outcomes when it comes to public safety.
So there's a lot to unpack there, and I've made a few notes of things I'd like to follow up on. Let's start with this question of accountability. You know, that's sort of a grievance that we hear across a variety of different public policy areas, and of course, conservative and libertarian types tend to harp on the, you know, the administrative state and how it's become so unaccountable and so much power has been delegated to it. What I'd like to explore a little bit is whether you think that the problem of accountability with respect to the criminal justice system is one of degree, or is it qualitatively different in your view from the accountability issues that we see elsewhere in public policy?
Oh, I think it's qualitatively different and qualitatively worse. So if you are somebody who generally worries about agencies run amok, that agencies that are kind of too zealous in their overall mission and not paying attention to kind of counter arguments or a downside to a fully aggressive approach, then nothing should worry you more than a prosecutor's office, because that is a government agency, and it is a government agency that pursues its mission with no cost-benefit analysis, no judicial review of their policies, no oversight of any kind at all, really. You know, they have immunity. They have absolute immunity for their decisions to prosecute, qualified immunity when they're investigating. No prosecutor, even when they engage in misconduct, really ever faces consequences for it. So it's kind of this zone of no accountability at all. And yet it suffers from all the same dynamics that I think scholars and others have rightly pointed out exist at agencies. You know, so a while back, Judge Doug Ginsburg and Doug DeMuth had pointed out, gosh, you know, agencies end up kind of getting really zealous in their mission, and they kind of pursue it at all costs because they don't think about how does my mission fit in with an overall system of government, or, you know, other things that we should be trading off and limited resources. You know, instead, an agency is basically all in on what it's supposed to do. And one reason they had advocated, for example, having greater oversight in the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the executive branch was to make sure there was kind of generalists that could check in and say, well, wait a minute, you know, show me that you've thought about the costs and the benefits. Show me that you've thought about other alternatives that might be less costly to this, you know, to try to kind of rein in that impulse. We don't do anything like that when it comes to prosecutors. And so they can go all in and do without facing any mechanism at all that counteracts or checks that. And so I do think that is a qualitatively different kind of thing. You know, they are not facing judicial review to make sure that their policies aren't arbitrary and capricious. They don't have any other the checks and balances that we see for other agencies. And, you know, people, reasonable people can disagree whether for other administrative agencies those checks do a good enough job or not. But in this space, there are no checks. So, you know, here, that should be more disconcerting, really, to everybody to just ask, how can we have an agency like that? And one that has increasingly taken on, you know, greater and greater power and influence. You know, that's how you have a system of so many people who go through the criminal justice system who are incarcerated, because these offices, these prosecutors' offices, have just grown more and more powerful.
Let's pick up on that a little bit. So in my prior professional life, I was a constitutional litigator at the Institute for Justice, and for a time I was head of the IJ's school choice team, where we spent a lot of time going up against what I think, objectively speaking, is the most powerful political lobby in the country, which is public teacher unions. I was amazed when I came over to do criminal justice reform to encounter what may be the second or third most strongest lobby in the country, which is the law enforcement lobby. Would you agree with that? And can you elaborate on this rather striking sentence from your book that I'm going to quote? On page 9 of your book, you say that law enforcement officials stand ready to fight any significant changes that would undermine their almost complete discretion to operate the system to their own advantage. Explain what you mean by that passage, if you would.
Yeah, so I think it's really important to notice that we have in the United States a really powerful set of special interests to maintain the status quo of incarceration, of mandatory minimum sentences, of long sentences on the books, and that would be law enforcement interests, because all those things help them to do their job more easily. You know, and I get it. You know, I'm not saying it's bad faith. Again, it kind of goes back to that, if that's your mission and you want to zealously pursue it, you kind of find yourself thinking, hey, give me as many tools as humanly possible so that I can do my job as easily and painlessly for me as possible. So as we've given over time, you know, we, the voters and our representatives, have passed things like mandatory minimum punishment and allowed them to use pretrial detention and cash bail, so that people are just in these positions where they'll plead to almost anything to get out of their pretrial detention, or they'll plead guilty because they're so worried to exercise their jury trial right that they're going to face sentences, you know, 10 times longer than if they plead. You know, those are really powerful tools for prosecutors. And whenever there's a discussion around the country to eliminate cash bail, change pretrial detention, lower sentences, get rid of mandatory minimums, these district attorneys attorney associations and prosecutors around the country rally around to oppose it. And, you know, they're very explicit at the federal level. I can tell you when there was some talk about changing mandatory minimums, the National Association of AUSAs wrote a letter that it just as plain as day says, well, don't do that, not because these are the right sentences and they're proportionate to the harm people are causing. It was, don't do that. We use these as tools for cooperation. You know, this is what we use so our job can be easier. You know, they don't want to go to trial. They don't want to have to prove their cases if they can instead coerce people to plead guilty. And so they're an enormously powerful lobbying group that legislators listen to. And we see this at the federal level, in the states, DA's associations and district attorneys around the country, countless examples of this, of them opposing legislation that would be reformist and advocating for more powers for themselves, advocating for longer sentence, more mandatories. And, you know, that's just the prosecutor lobbying associations. They're often joined by police officers, police officer unions, corrections officer unions. You know, we have a very large now, you know, in absolute numbers, number of people whose livelihoods depend on big government when it comes to criminal law enforcement. And, you know, they have a stake in keeping it exactly where where we have things now. And I think the question for the rest of us is to ask, are they guardians of our interests of public safety, or are they just looking out for professional, what makes their job easier? And you know, I think the evidence is quite clear that unfortunately, they're not dovetailing. Their professional interests are not the same as our interests in the public. They are doing things that are contrary to public safety, that are wasting money, that are bad for constitutional liberties. And so it's not the case that they are perfect agents for us. In fact, often it's exactly the opposite.
So I'm gonna give you a slow pitch over the middle of the plate and do with it what you will. But a common refrain from police and prosecutors when someone points out some feature of the system that is particularly kind of unfair or obnoxious, or even a specific case. I remember there was a case one time where I think a woman went to a police station in, I believe, South Carolina to report theft of some piece of property. And while she was there, they ran her ID and discovered there was a warrant out for her arrest because she failed to return a videotape, the Blockbuster, back in the day when there was a Blockbuster and there was videotape. So she was arrested on the spot. Sometimes when we hear stories about that and we, you know, bring up the unfairness of the system, we'll hear from police and prosecutors, hey, listen, I don't make the laws, I just enforce them. Do you think that's a fair statement or a fair response?
No, I mean, definitely not. It ignores the reality that they are absolutely key in lobbying for the substantive content of laws. If you go to any state house in America, they're part of the process. They are asking for things. They are opposing other things. You know, I'd say they're one of the leading lobbying groups in America. And when it comes to prosecutors in particular, but also police officers, you know, they are in the thick of asking for things that at the federal level, you can, because there's good legislative history to kind of be able to track where they've been. Whereas state legislative history, sometimes it's harder to get the paper trail, but their fingerprints are all over everything. You know, the Department of Justice is constantly asking Congress to do things, and then Congress does it. And the same is true at the state level. It's just sometimes you can't find the paper record, but if you interview anyone in a state house in America, they will tell you that they hear constantly from district attorneys and their associations asking for things. So they are directly involved in writing the laws, you know, literally with their pen and computers figuring out exactly what the content should be. But then even above that, once the law is passed, the amount of discretion they have to decide who does and who doesn't find themselves facing criminal charges and what charges to bring, you know, it's hard to call that level of discretion anything other than a lawmaking capacity of its own, because it's unreviewable if a prosecutor decides to dismiss charges against somebody. And so, you know, they hold enormous power over people's lives, and they don't bring actions against everyone. And they pick and choose. They pick and choose, and once they target somebody, they pick and choose which charges to bring, because there's so many laws on the books that for any given set of criminal facts and conduct, prosecutors can choose from a range of different possible things to charge. And so they both exercise direct writing of the laws, and then in the exercise of their discretion and who they're picking, they're making all kinds of policy calls. You know, they could decide, you know, we don't want to bring shoplifting charges anymore in our jurisdiction because there's other things that are too important. And, you know, as a result of that, that just becomes something that's not enforced anymore. Or they could decide that, yeah, we're going to bring firearms charges, but we're only going to bring it against people from this neighborhood. You know, whenever else we see someone who has a felony record with a firearm in their home, we're not really worried about it. We're worried about it here because we think there's too much gun violence in this community. And so, you know, as they make those kinds of decisions, I think we have to realistically view that as also making the laws as well.
Great. Well, let's change gears a little bit. I want to pick up on another point that you made and tie it to something you said in your book that I think is underappreciated and very important. You talk about basically kind of a failure to follow the data to confront the actual effect of various policies that are embraced. And of course, that's a major reason why people who support kind of a more limited role for government, that can be both a matter of philosophy, but also for practical reasons, that the unintended consequences are a constant factor in our system. And very often, policies that are intended to produce one set of results produce quite a different set of results. And you raise this concern in your book that it's possible that in some settings, government can even be criminogenic, which is to say that government itself can be a generator of criminal activity. And you make that point specifically in connection with pretrial detention. Can you explain that and kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think there's a conventional set of assumptions about pretrial detention that, wow, the more people we detain pretrial, the better. Because if you're someone who watches your local news or reads the paper, if there is an instance of someone who was let out, for example, posted cash bail and then commits another violent crime, you know, the thought is, oh my gosh, why weren't they detained? And whenever there's that failing in the system, it gets news coverage and people focus on it. And I think that leads people to believe, wow, we should really want to detain as many people as possible to avoid stories like that. But, you know, what you don't get news coverage of and you never read about is the fact that when you are detaining people, and most of the people who are detained, you know, they are there because they just can't afford the bail. It's not that they're there because, you know, there was some score of how much of a risk to society they are. They are just so poor that they can't make $500 bail. They can't get a bail bondsman. They can't make the deposit to get the larger amount. They're too poor. And so as a result of that, they're detained pretrial. And what you don't hear about is that when people are detained, even for a couple days, it's a life-altering event. You know, usually that means you're going to lose your job. People are often evicted from their home because they lose their job. They can't pay their rent. They're out. They're kicked out on the street. They lose custody of their children because there's no one to take care of them, and they get become wards of the state. I mean, this is something that is a spiraling event in a life. And so when empirical researchers have looked at it, they tried to study people who, you know, charged with the same crime, same criminal history, but, you know, some people can make bail and get out, and some people are detained. And what they found are the people who are detained, when they do ultimately, you know, get released back into society, they're more likely to commit crimes, precisely because, you know, the detention itself created all these other negative consequences in their life and made it really hard for them to be on a law-abiding path. So the actual detention was the problem, not, you know, anything else associated with them. And I think that's there's so many examples like that where we have state intervention that ends up being counterproductive. And you know, I understand why the people who ask for the detention do it. The judges, you know, don't want to risk that someone that they do release is going to commit some violent crime, you know, because that will make the news, whereas they're never going to be held accountable when they're detaining too many people. And same for prosecutors. So they all have this professional interest. Most of them are elected. They don't want to lose the next election if there's a bad outcome. So they over-detain. And the result is, you know, we have almost 500,000 people who are in jails around the country in the United States who've never been convicted of anything. You know, it's about 20% or so, 20 to 25% of our total population of people incarcerated are there. They haven't been convicted of anything. And for almost all of them, they could be safely out with no risk to the community. And by keeping them detained, we're making them more likely to struggle when they do finally get out, which most people do, by the way. You know, to the extent people are unaware of this, you know, 95% of the people who find themselves incarcerated for any length of time will rejoin their communities. And we should always be asking ourselves, you know, are we making it harder for them when they do rejoin communities to stay law-abiding, or are these state interventions making things worse?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, an important point, and it bears maybe just a bit more discussion to underscore that designating some activity to be a crime and then bringing the sort of the full force of the state to bear on people who transgress is a really big deal, and it's not cost-free. Of course, it costs money to enforce those laws, to prosecute them, to inflict whatever punishment, including incarceration. Those are all out-of-pocket costs. But then, of course, there are other costs, including the fact that once you put somebody behind bars, you're going to substantially disrupt their life. They may lose their job. They may lose their housing if they have a family. That's a potential supporter of the family that is no longer there. The data shows that the children who grow up in a home that is missing one parent because that parent is incarcerated tend to have worse outcomes, so et cetera, et cetera. So you ought to be extraordinarily careful before you decide to go that route. and declare a particular activity to be criminal and bring the full sanction of the state to bear. Do you think that we are careful in this country about what conduct we designate as criminal?
Oh, gosh, no. You know, I mean, we can't even count all the things that are criminal. Which to me is the perfect illustration of how much we've overdone this. You know, we cannot get an accurate count of how many things are federal crimes because we have so many regulatory offenses that, you know, if you do them willfully or knowingly, they turn into federal crimes. So it kind of incorporates all the federal regulations that are out there. You know, it's how you can have that great crime a day Twitter feed of all the different things that you could do that turn you into a criminal. And it's not, again, it's not just federal. State codes are really big. And not only do we over-criminalize underlying conduct, when we do identify conduct to criminalize, we over-punish it. You know, we use increasingly longer sentences. We turn more and more things into felonies. And then we give people collateral consequences for having felony convictions that make, again, you know, really set them up to fail. We deprive them of access to driver's licenses. So they can't get they don't have a driver's license if they have, let's say, a drug felony conviction. Well, now they can't drive to a job because a lot of people live in places where there is no public transportation. So, you know, it's this kind of unthinking use of excessive, heavy-handed state interference without much thought to, well, is there a downside to this? And again, I think it does go back to this accountability point because no one's ever stopped to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, why are you doing this? Did you look to make sure that on net this would be good for society and public safety? And because that never happens, you know, people have incentives to overuse this thing. Politicians do because, you know, they want to look like they're tackling a problem. And instead of really getting at underlying issues with the problem, the easiest thing in the world is to just say, oh, you know what I'll do? I'll turn it into a crime. I'll turn it into a crime and I'll increase the sentence if it's already a crime. It's just this kind of knee-jerk, unthinking way of approaching things. And the same is true, you know, when prosecutors want to kind of establish their record, they show how aggressive they were in a particular area. And when we do that collectively, that's, you know, how you end up with having a country that is the largest incarcerator on the face of the earth and way different from historically how we did it. You know, all this is just basically the, you know, last four decades or so that the United States has turned to this kind of a model. This isn't how it used to be, but it really is an excessive use of enormous state power. And I think, you know, anyone who has any kind of skepticism of government involvement in people's lives, there is no reason that you should have a line in your head that says, well, I'm only worried about it when it's civil involvement, but not criminal, because it all the same issues apply and, in fact, are magnified when it comes to state interference and calling things crimes and punishing people. And I do think anyone who's had any personal involvement with this or knows someone who has, it immediately becomes obvious to you. And so, to me, this is just a question of waiting for enough people to have this kind of proximity to the issues before, you know, things start to turn. And that is why I think it's already starting to happen, because we have 1 in 3 adults in America have a criminal record. When you have statistics like that, you know, you have the basis for a political movement to seek change.
One of the things that I find quite frustrating is the tendency on the part of some people in the demographic that is more likely to be listening, for example, to a teleforum like this, to kind of poo-poo the issue of overcriminalization. I just want to tell a quick kind of anecdote. There's a USA Today article from this year that notes that in 2007, Shreveport, Louisiana passed a law making it a crime to wear pants that are saggy so that they expose your underwear. Now, that sounds ridiculous, but guess what? There were 726 arrests using that law, and it was only repealed in June of this year after a police officer shot and killed a 31-year-old man for while trying to arrest him for wearing saggy pants. So just because there's nobody rotting in prison for selling mixed nuts with fewer than 3 different kinds, which in fact is a federal crime, we know that from the Crime a Day Twitter feed, there are still people who are exposed to the full violence of the state for ridiculous things like wearing saggy pants in a jurisdiction where you could walk down the street, you know, in a bikini if you wanted to. So the good news is, and I want to sort of change gears here, but really not change gears that much. The good news is that there's an app for this, right? There's an app for overcriminalization. It's the jury trial. But you have another, I think, rather stark passage in your book that I want to read and then have you kind of invite you to elaborate on. You say in your book that the framers constructed a constitutional architecture to guard against pathological politics, including the politics of overcriminalization. I inserted that. But their design assumed a world of criminal trials and a simpler body of laws that no longer exists. I absolutely agree with that, but I'd love for you to kind of unpack that and tell people what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I'm so great about our constitutional structure is how much of this had been anticipated. You know, some problems you say, oh, wow, if the framers had only known, what might they have done? But this is one that was on their radar screen, and you can find it in the Federalist Papers. They talk about how laws will, you know, partake of too much severity, and you need checks on them. And one of the key checks that they had in place was the jury, which was in the Constitution in Article 3, even before the Bill of Rights, you know, which is just sort of shows you how front and center and important it was. And the idea is, of course, before the government can come in and take somebody's liberty away, you've got to be able to convince people outside the government, ordinary citizens, that the government gets to do this to you. You know, so it was a key check of ordinary people on the process. What ends up unfortunately happening, though, to that key check is that if unlike other constitutional rights where the Supreme Court has made very clear that the government can't put a price tag on it, can't say, oh, you know, you want to exercise your First Amendment rights, well, you know, that's going to cost you. They do that, exactly that, when it comes to the jury trial right. And, you know, for years, we've always had some kind of underlying amount of plea bargaining in the system. You know, you plead guilty, you get some time off your sentence. But people didn't think it was actually allowed, so it was kind of done on the down low. And then in the 1970s, the Supreme Court says it's okay. You know, just gives it an imprimatur that says, well, no, this is how the system survives, and it's fine. And as soon as the court says that, we go from a plea bargaining rate of about 75% of all cases that end in a conviction being the result of pleas to where we are now, which the statistics are anywhere from 95 to 97%, which is an enormous increase. And the other shift that we start to see after the court says this is fine is prosecutors get really bold in the kinds of things they threaten people if they go to trial. So they say, hey, you want to go to trial? Well, then I'm gonna bring a new indictment. I'm going to supersede the indictment, and I'm going to bring charges that will have a mandatory minimum attached of a life sentence or 30 years. But if you plead now, you know, I'll let you get away with 5. And I think when we see those kinds of negotiations, it's pretty obvious that there's no way the prosecutor thinks this person really deserves 30 years or life, or they wouldn't be offering 5 years right now. And so, you know, I think it's obvious that that is just done to make people not go and exercise their jury trial right. And it's coercive. And, you know, it's putting a price tag on that really critical check of the system. And I think it's one of the wrong turns that the Supreme Court has made. And, you know, I think it's a real question about whether or not the court can start to ease up on that. Because when they made these decisions where they accepted it, they did say things like, well, you know, we are not seeing evidence of prosecutors using this just to coerce people to plead guilty. You know, they kind of saw it as an efficient tool. But, you know, and then they also said, and, you know, it's certainly not the case that it's being used where innocent people find themselves pleading guilty. Well, you know, fast forward to today, we know that at least 10% of the cases with proven DNA evidence showing people to be innocent were the results of pleas, where people who were innocent pleaded guilty just because they were that much more worried about going to trial, because if they did lose there, the punishment was just so harsh. So, you know, we have a system that's dominated by pleas where juries have very little say. And, you know, even when you go to trial and you have a jury, they can't be told what kind of punishment you're facing, even if it's a mandatory punishment. You know, they're not told that they have the right, they have the power to give an acquittal in a case for whatever reason that they want to. You know, instead, they're really micromanaged. And so even when you get it, there's not a lot of wiggle room. So people are rightly afraid to exercise that right when they have this enormous risk of increased punishment at stake. And I think it's one of the greatest failings of our modern constitutional case law was the Supreme Court allowing that to happen.
Well, I agree. And another part of my professional background is I did medical malpractice defense work at the beginning of my career. My sister's a doctor. My dad was a NASA engineer and an aerospace engineer after that. And so those are two areas I know pretty well. And I know that both in the medical field and in commercial aviation, they take the possibility of a really serious like disaster, like a plane crash or a really serious act of medical malpractice. They take that incredibly seriously. And they have something called a Sentinel Incident Review, where if something like that happens, you drop everything that you're doing and you look at the system. You look at the process to see how it could possibly have produced such an intolerable result. And I'm just flabbergasted that the one area where there are you know, similarly high stakes that shows no interest in examining the process to see how an intolerable outcome occurred is criminal justice, where somebody has been coerced into pleading guilty to a crime that we later determined they did not commit. And not only does not, there's no sort of systematic review of the process that led to that result, just to kind of treat it as business as usual, and they just go on as if no big deal. Why, like, can you think of any way to try to, you know, have the government or prosecutors have more skin in the game so that they are more sensitive about the possibility of these kinds of intolerable outcomes?
Yeah, I think it does go back to accountability, because when these things happen, no one loses their job. No one faces, they don't even give, you know, if there's any kind of monetary judgment, and they're usually, frankly, small dollar amounts, you know, they don't come out of the budget of any of the actors who are involved. And so there's no way in which people internalize what they have done or even think about it as they're currently making decisions. Oh, I should be really careful here. Now, I will say, I think people who do these jobs, police and prosecutors, you know, I think the vast overwhelming number of them want to get the right result. They're not doing anything deliberately bad. And I think it's a tiny percentage of people who are engaged in kind of any kind of intentional misconduct. But, you know, we set up our structure of government in the United States focusing on people who will do bad things, and also to make sure that even good faith efforts to do things, that people have all the right incentives to do a good job. And when it comes to this area, there's no accountability. And, you know, here again, you can point to court decisions where you have a Supreme Court that just created immunity doctrines out of whole cloth, absolute immunity, qualified immunity. Those aren't in the text of the statute. They are not historically grounded. So, you know, any kind of good textualist, good originalist, that is nowhere to be found. And they're terrible policies. So, you know, you could think about them as a bad way of judicial interpretation. And then to add insult to injury, you know, they're also terrible policies. And so I think if we had better accountability for when mistakes are made, as a matter of constitutional doctrine, but even apart from thinking about the constitutional doctrine, having jurisdictions take this more seriously than they do. And, you know, it's a question of what mobilizes government to do that. You know, sometimes it's a lawsuit where they have to pay out money, but that hasn't seemed to do the trick. So I think it's going to become one where voter mobilization is going to start to get at more of these issues. And I think that's starting to happen. But, you know, I will just say this is one of those spaces that, again, I don't think this is a liberal, conservative, Democratic, Republican kind of divide at all. And in fact, a lot of these doctrinal spaces that we've talked about so far today, you know, are right in the heartland of originalist methodologies. You know, these are decisions that Supreme Court justices got wrong precisely because they diverted from a textualist or an originalist methodology and ended up with these just really terrible policies. Because if there's any kind of governing methodology when it comes to constitutional jurisprudence these days, it's we'll just defer to whatever the government wants. And, you know, that is not a good methodology. And it's not a good methodology in criminal law cases in particular, and it leads to really terrible outcomes.
It seems to me that any originalist worthy of the name should be deeply concerned about whatever constellation of doctrines and practices leads or has led to the practical extinction of the criminal jury trial on American soil. Very clearly, the framers would have been extraordinarily concerned about that, and we've essentially, like the proverbial frog boiling in water, have just allowed it to happen. Let's finish on a related note here. Near the end of your book, you say that one cannot expect much scrutiny of the government from a bench overwhelmingly occupied by prosecutors. And as you know, Cato just released a study earlier this week in which we did what no one has done before, which is to look at the background of every sitting non-senior federal judge to check and see whether that conventional wisdom is true. Is it in fact the case that prosecutors are overrepresented on the federal bench? And the results of that study were absolutely yes. Just to summarize, if you look at people who have worked in the criminal justice system, but only for one side, prosecution or defense, prosecutors are 4-1 prosecutors to criminal defense attorneys on the bench. And if you expand that to look at people who either were courtroom advocates for government or courtroom advocates for individuals against government in a criminal defense or public interest setting, then the ratio is 7-1. So we absolutely have a federal judiciary on which former government advocates vastly outnumber advocates for individuals against government. Let's finish our discussion and move into taking questions with you just kind of elaborating on what you think are the consequences or what are some of the effects of a judiciary in which that we've allowed to become so imbalanced.
Yeah, I just think it's insane to have ratio that looks like that. You know, I'm not someone who thinks we should bar any professional background from the bench. I think it's great to have people with all kinds of backgrounds, but to have it so tilted toward people who have spent their lives or a large portion of their lives working for the government is disconcerting, because so much of what a judge has to do is ask whether or not the government has overstepped, you know, to enforce the Constitution against the government. And if you have a professional background where you did that, and, you know, probably you were an honorable governmental employee, you know, you rose through the ranks, you became a judge, I would have to believe you kind of represent the best of government behavior. I think there's a lot of cognitive disconnect then that would be involved in having to say, but I can really scrutinize here and think about cases where the government didn't live up to that. You know, I think, are there people who can do that? For sure. You know, are there people who do that? Absolutely. But in designing a bench, you would want to have people who have also spent a professional life suing the government, who have exposure to the places where government has gone wrong, because then they have that sensitivity to those instances, and they can bring that to, if it's an appellate court, the group discussions of government behavior. And it's just, you know, an additional background and perspective that I think is well worth having on the bench. And I think, you know, you've made really good points, Clark, about asking, you know, it doesn't guarantee, you know, if we're going to hire umpires for a sports league, you know, sure, we would expect them to be neutral given the role that they're in, but I don't think that anybody, you know, if you were a Red Sox fan, would want a slate of umpires who were lifelong Yankees fans. Like, it just, they can try to step out of their role, but it may color things at the margins, you know, it may be, and it also, I think, makes people from the outside really kind of lose some faith in the integrity of the institution to have it look like that. And so I think professional diversity is really important. I also think it's really important to make sure there are people, you know, committed to the idea of liberty and who have expressed that and made it quite clear that that's something that they're committed to. And I think, you know, particularly for a Federalist Society audience, you know, there is a vast difference between a justice in the mold of Justice Gorsuch, for example, who really does stick to originalist interpretations, is more of a textualist, you know, more like I will say my old boss Justice Scalia than Justice Alito, who really just rules for the government in criminal cases. I mean, you can predict with almost 100% accuracy how he's going to come out, because it just doesn't even matter what any of the foundational documents say. It's the government and it's a criminal case, and you know, you kind of come out one way. And it's been so rare that it's been anything other than that. And you know, I think it's important when selecting judges that we get people who aren't going to be reflexively voting in favor of the government when the number one thing of their job is to make sure that the government stays within constitutional bounds.
Well, on that not at all controversial point, why don't we pause? I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. I hope that our listeners have too. And now we get to the point where we're going to take some questions, and hopefully people have some.
We will now go to our first question.
Rachel, you are terrific. I hadn't thought of it before, the way you put it about the interest groups being the lawmakers, the way they hang around in the interstices of the state houses. But now you've also made me think that the media is a lawmaker. I'm involved right now as an amicus curiae in the appeal of Boston Marathon bomber case. And I would think any reasonably educated person looking at the transcripts and looking at the evidence would know that that guy is innocent. I mean, there's like no evidence. But the Boston Globe, the CNN, have so persuaded everyone that, normally I live in Australia and I can speak up all I want down there about the Marathon case. Nobody gets upset. But here, wow, I've recently tried talking to a few people and, you know, it's like a blasphemy. I'm offending God if I say anything other than the party line on this particular criminal case. So I'm just here to underscore what you said and add in the media as a lawmaker.
Thank you for that. No, I think the media, I don't know the specifics, I will say. I haven't followed enough to say anything about the facts, underlying facts of that case, but I will say that the dynamic that you're talking about with media involvement has been terrible. You know, they're really, you know, the thing that gets viewers, if you watch the evening news for decades now, about a third of any local evening newscast is a crime story. And that's true whether crime is up or down, because you only need just a couple to fill the airwaves. And you know, the more sensationalized, obviously, the better for viewership. And so the result of that is the public doesn't have a really good sense of whether crime is going up or down, and also what most crimes look like in their jurisdiction. And you know, that is a real problem for policymaking and law reform, because legislators then legislate with kind of the high-profile cases as the backdrop and don't take a lot of time to really think how a given law will actually be applied in a particular place, who's going to be affected. So the policies are all set with the worst possible cases in mind, and that's how you end up with over-criminalization, over-punishment.
All right.
Thank
we'll
you.
Now move to our next caller.
Hi, this is David Hubert. I'm calling from Atlanta. If I accept your argument, my concern is this battling of data. And how do we get to an honest broker to deal with data on both sides of the issue in order to form an opinion? Is there any solution to that?
So that's a good question. And I will just say right up front, there's going to be spaces where the data is incomplete and we're going to have to make policy calls because the data is only going to tell us so much. And, you know, at that point, you have to, it's going to be the discretion of the people you voted into office and, you know, kind of who you want making those decisions when the data falls short and doesn't tell you something. But there are so many areas where the data is consistent and quite clear, and particularly quite clear that a given policy is bad for public safety. So, you know, an example I'll give you would be the removing of driver's licenses for from people who have unpaid traffic tickets, unpaid fines, drug convictions, so things completely unrelated to their ability as drivers. That is a terrible public policy when it comes to crime reduction, because it now means people have to decide between driving on a suspended license, which is itself against the law, or they don't have a license and then they can't get a job because it's like a 4 or 5 hour commute to any place of employment. It just makes it impossible. And so they may choose, frankly, to commit more crimes because that's the only option available to them. So, you know, the studies there, the data there, that's really clear. And the only reason you'd want to keep a driver's license prohibition would be, frankly, because you're just so angry at someone for doing whatever crime or fact it is that they haven't done, because it's a terrible policy. I mean, and it's not cost effective. The money, it's not a revenue generator to then put people in prison again for driving on a suspended license and then say, you know, you're going to keep losing it till you pay back the debt. It just, on every measure, it fails. So there's policies like that where I think data becomes very clear about what it is we should do, and the key is just putting mechanisms in place where we view it. But I will say, there's a lot of policies like that. There's a lot of policies where we actually have really good information and it's not subject to interpretation. But I do want to concede that you're right in asking, you know, what do we do when it is something that, you know, the data just tells us, you know, length of sentence. You know, we know longer sentences at some point become criminogenic. They make it just too hard for people to reenter, and they themselves cause recidivism. But honestly, we can't pinpoint exactly when that is. And so at some point, you're making a guess about, okay, I'm getting some incapacitation benefit from sentencing someone for a particular length of time, but at some point, the sentence becomes too long, and they would have aged out of crime anyway, and now the sentence itself is causing harm. And, you know, we have fantastic criminologists in the United States. They can't tell us when that point is. So that's a little bit of guesswork. And at that point, I think, you know, the best that you can do is put people who are in the positions of making the decision about what to do, you know, people who are smart, people who get the trade-offs, and, you know, are as thoughtful as possible in a realm where the data is incomplete.
We'll now move to the next question.
This is Bob Zadick. I have two questions. I abhor, of course, all the plea bargaining, the 97%. But if we didn't have plea bargaining, how could this country possibly absorb all the jury trials? We'd end up with every federal building being nothing but criminal justice courthouses. And in the same vein, I equally abhor prosecutorial discretion, but with so many criminal laws, if a prosecutor doesn't exercise discretion, what's the alternative? That he brings every criminal trial, anytime there's a crime, no matter how minor, we couldn't possibly absorb it. So I wonder if you can help with solutions to these horrible problems.
So, you know, I will say that I think, and Clark, if you want to weigh in on this too, but, you know, I think one thing that would happen is we'd have fewer cases brought in the first place. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that would require jurisdictions to just think about their resources and where do we really need criminal law as opposed to a different kind of response? Because criminal law has become kind of a cheap, easy place to go for a whole variety of things that could be dealt with as civil matters or as non-governmental matters entirely. So I actually think it's good that we would have fewer trials. And I think necessarily we would have to. You know, the other thing we could do is we could have, yeah, sure, you could get some kind of a small discount if you plead guilty. But the difference between, you know, saying, hey, here's a small discount versus here's an enormous penalty that you're going to have if you go to jury trial, you know, those are two very different things. And I think if you made that a much smaller gap between what it is that you were facing at trial versus pleading guilty, I think you'd still have pleas. You'd still have people who would do it for the much smaller discount, but you'd get rid of that enormous prosecutorial leverage. But I think government, it is expensive, and I think we as the framers wanted it to be. You know, they wanted it to be really hard for the government to act across a whole range of things. It's why they separated powers. It's why they make it really difficult for the government to do anything, because they were not about efficiency. They were in the business of protecting liberty, and I think it should be expensive before the government gets to do that, so that we as a community decide, when do we really want to spend all that money to take away somebody's liberty? I think it would bring some rationalization to how we do things. And I'll just say empirically, if you kind of want an example of this, in California, when the Supreme Court said that their prisons were overcrowded and it was unconstitutional because people couldn't get medical care in their prisons as a result of there being too many people, the Supreme Court said you have to reduce your prison population by about 35,000. And California's response to that was, okay, so we have to reduce our state prison population. What we'll do is we'll release those folks, we'll send them to their local communities, and we'll give our local communities some grant money to try to figure out what to do with them. Because, you know, normally when a district attorney or a county prosecutor brings a case and sends somebody to state prison, they don't pay for state prison. That comes out of the state budget. So, you know, it's a phrase that Frank Zimmerman uses. It's a correctional free lunch. It's a free resource. And so, of course, they're overusing it. But as soon as California went back to these local communities and said, well, here, they're coming to you, and here's some money, but not enough to cover their jail stays, you decide what to do with it. And, you know, magic of magic, the local communities were like, oh, you know, it turns out these people don't need to be imprisoned. You know, they, you know, if we have to pay for it and we look closely at their cases, we realize they could actually be free and there's other ways to deal with them. And as a result of that, California did see an enormous drop in their incarceration population. They didn't just go into jails, and there wasn't an increase in crime. So having the resource constraint, I think, can be a very good thing.
Thanks for that question, Bob. Because Clark, I'm going to jump in really quickly and say this. Let's be clear that it's not an all or nothing thing. There aren't very many people advocating for the complete elimination of plea bargaining, and I don't think it's realistic anyway. Neither is getting rid of prosecutorial discretion, which is, as you suggest, quite correctly, an inevitable feature of our system. But to pick up on something Rachel said, the system as it's currently constructed has a lot of perverse incentives, and we're missing a lot of low-hanging fruit that would help, you know, better align those incentives. Just take one fact. There are more arrests for marijuana possession in 2017 than for all violent index crimes combined. Those are the most serious kinds of violent crimes. That doesn't make any sense. Not all of those arrests lead to a prosecution and incarceration, but every single one of them consumes scarce resources in an already sort of overtaxed criminal justice system. So we need not just more discretion, but we need that discretion exercised in a way that is more in line with what's really good for society. And I will end by saying this. I don't know what the correct amount of enforcement of criminal laws in this country is, but I do know that if we are not prepared to spend at least a couple of $100,000 to basically comply with the constitutionally prescribed mechanism for adjudicating criminal charges, which is a jury trial, then I don't think we're serious enough about to be putting somebody in prison and taking away their liberty for some period of time. We've been doing it on the cheap for too long, and I think it's really perverted the system.
We'll now move to our next question.
I joined a little bit late, and I hope I'm not going to ask a question that you covered, but just a comment on the legislature kind of imposing on the judiciary by having mandatory sentencing guidelines, tying arms and legs and neck to make them incarcerate, and as a second question, alternatives to incarceration, and let you both comment.
So the rise in mandatory minimum punishments or mandatory guidelines, you know, I think the intent was, you know, and again, I think a lot of this kind of tragedy of where we are today is I don't think this was done in, you know, bad faith to create some massive system of incarceration. You know, I think people had good intentions, but unfortunately they went awry in what actually happened. So with mandatory sentencing, mandatory guidelines, the focus was on wide disparities among judges in how they were sentencing people, racial disparities, geographic disparity, you know, all kinds of concerns. It mattered which judge you ended up getting. And so legislative responses were to have these mandatory guidelines or mandatory minimums. And they just didn't think about or didn't think enough about the fact that that was just going to transfer power to prosecutors, because that is exactly what those laws do. Instead of, cabining it so that people are treated the same, people are treated more differently in regimes that have mandatory guidelines and mandatory sentences. Because it just shifts it over to prosecutors to decide what to charge, and that then dictates the sentence. And if prosecutors have variation in their charging patterns, which they do, we have an increase in disparities. And so you can see that's been empirically demonstrated at the federal level. Mandatory minimum sentencing, prosecutors don't bring the mandatory minimum in all the cases that they could. They disproportionately bring it in cases against people of color. It's erratically applied, so it's not a good deterrent. You know, it doesn't do any of the things that I think the lawmakers thought that it would do. And so, you know, we are definitely better off giving judges some discretion, because when we do that, it acts as a nice counterbalance against prosecutors. So now at least you have another actor in the system that can look at prosecutorial behavior and make sure that they didn't go far in one direction. So I think, you know, that one is again, that's another one of those areas where we have really good empirical evidence that those things did not work as intended and in fact produced worse results. And when it comes to alternatives to incarceration, you know, I think we should absolutely be pursuing those in lots of areas, but I do think we should be driven by data. And there, you know, not every alternative to incarceration works. Lots of people have programs that are great and that are good, but unfortunately there are some programs that aren't. And so I think we should in general support that, but we should also make sure that any program that somebody is sent to has been proven to reduce recidivism and works.
All right, we'll now move to our last question in the queue.
Good afternoon. This is Miriam Moore in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for your talk. I found it very interesting. I've been listening to the conversation about criminal justice reform and use of force reform over the last few years and find many of the arguments persuasive. One thing I've heard from others who are more skeptical is that we're willing to make these changes, or we're perhaps more inclined to make these changes now because we're living in a time of historically low crime, and we've forgotten what it was like to be in a time when there was much more crime and much more violent crime in the United States, and that's why these reforms are being considered. Do you have anything to say in response to people who make that argument?
I think politically they're absolutely right. You know, I think if we had higher crime rates or we were suffering from a crime wave, it'd be harder to have a rational discussion about what to do. So they're right on the politics, but I would just caution that they're not right if the implication is we need these things to keep crime low, because that's not true. In fact, when people have tried to figure out exactly how much the drop in crime that we've seen in the United States, which thankfully we have, you know, how much is that attributable to using longer sentences, you know, more prosecutions, more incarceration? And the highest estimate has it as being responsible for about 25% of the decline, which means, you know, kind of 75% of this, and that's the highest. You know, other estimates put it at like 3% contribution to that, and some have it as being criminogenic and causing more crime than it's stopping. So, you know, the studies range all over the place, but even if you take the one that is the most generous and says, you know, it's maybe responsible for about a quarter of the decline, that means that really what's dropping crime are other things, you know, that at least three quarters of it is being done by other things. And that could be anything from removing lead from communities because of the association it has with mental health problems in communities. It could be gentrification in urban areas. There's a whole range of other possible things that reduce crime that aren't our response in these areas. And many of those other things are cheaper and easier to do. But even if we then look at, okay, there are some things we do that do help to reduce crime. crime. And I think it's important to note that and pay attention to it. We only want to keep doing the things that we know are helpful and not the things we know that are harmful. So as opposed to kind of thinking them as a big glob of stuff we should continue to do, we should separate out all the different policies. So, you know, so for example, while it is true that having more police around, people are very responsive to being caught. That's the best deterrent. Surveillance, odds of detection. But they're not very deterred by longer punishments because people think, well, if I don't get caught, I don't have to worry about that long punishment. So, you know, in thinking about how to deploy resources, if you were trying to decide to do it, you know, there's better ways to improve detection than necessarily going with longer sentences. You know, similarly, these collateral consequences of conviction have all proven to be terrible for reducing crime, precisely because they make it so difficult for people to get jobs, get housing, lead law-abiding lives. So I think we can be more nuanced in our response to those kinds of things. But I do think, you know, I don't want to live in communities that aren't safe, you know, and I think most people who do criminal law reform share that view. You know, we all want the same goal. And the key is just being very mindful of what works and what doesn't work. And it's just not true that this massive buildup, and I will say one last thing empirically about that, is we do have kind of the natural experiment of the states on this score. And we have had states around the country that have dramatically reduced their incarceration rates and dramatically changed their policies, you know, places like California and others, and they have not seen an increase in crime when they've done it. So we both have the empirical studies where people have tried to do all their multivariate analysis, and then we have what we can see with our own eyes in jurisdictions around the country that have cut sentences, and they're saving money and they're lowering crime. So it definitely, it's a false choice to think that these are the policies we need to keep crime low.
And I'm going to quickly exercise my moderator's privilege to make a perhaps distinctly libertarian point, and which is this. Arguably the two most powerful generators of criminal activity known to man are, first, to create black markets, and second, to fail to socialize young men. So if you want to have a tremendous amount of crime, the first thing you do is outlaw something that lots of people want to do and will continue doing anyway and will have to be supplied through a black market. And second, put lots of fathers in prison so that young men don't have fathers to socialize them. And pause and ask yourself whether or not we've gone down both of those roads.
All right, and I know Rachel has a class to teach and get to, so I'll go ahead and close this right at the top of the hour. I'll give either of you a chance for any closing remarks if you would like.
I think I just made mine.
And I just wanted to say thank you to everybody.
All right, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank both of our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.